This program is brought to you by Cabinet, a nonprofit arts organization based in Brooklyn, New York. Cabinet depends on your support to continue our activities. For more information, visit us online at cabinetmagazine.org.
First installment of the series, The Magazine is Medium. My name is Sina Najafi, and I'm going to hand over the mic in a second to Lori Cole, who's organized the series and has done all the heavy lifting. So I will just very briefly say a huge thanks to our participants tonight, to Lauren, to Betsy, and to Kim. And, of course, to Lori for organizing the series.
Thank you. So I want to thank all of you for coming tonight. I also want to thank Sina, with whom I collaborated to organize this series. I also want to thank the staff of Cabinet Magazine for their work in putting this series together, and of course thank our panelists for so generously sharing their expertise and their time with us tonight. I think what you're hearing is the heat kicking in. So before we begin, I thought I'd give you a framework for the series as a whole, as well as tell you a little bit about what to expect in tonight's panel. So the idea behind the series was to bring together academics who study magazines, and the magazine is increasingly an object of scholarly inquiry, and to bring those academics into conversation with editors, with critics, artists, writers, and readers like yourselves, to jointly assess the magazine as a medium. So the way we decided to approach this was to look at three sites of interaction between editors and their contributors or readers for magazines. And those three sites are the interview, which we'll talk about tonight, the questionnaire, which we'll talk about on May 11th, and the letter to the editor, which we'll discuss on June 18th. And I hope you can come to those events as well. So these three sites, the interview, the questionnaire, and the letter to the editor, are, as I mentioned, sites of interaction between editors and their readers or contributors. And they're also, they're often overlooked and under-theorized, and they're often constitutive of a magazine's identity. So they're often what the magazine is best known for, or how a magazine articulates its identity in print through these conversations with their contributors and readers. So tonight we have with us two editors of exemplary magazines. We have Lauren Stein, the editor of the Paris Review, and Betsy Sussler, the co-founder, publisher, and editor-in-chief of Bomb Magazine. And they will discuss with us tonight the relationship between the interview and their publications. So some of the questions that might be raised include what makes for a good interviewer and interview subject, what is it like to transcribe and edit and print and then subsequently read these interviews? What kind of historical record do they leave? And especially, I want to ask, what is the relationship between this form of the interview and the identity of these publications? Both of these magazines are very well known for their incisive author and artist interviews. So moderating our discussion tonight, we have Kim Conady, who is an assistant curator in the Department of Prints and Drawings at the Museum of Modern Art, and she is also a scholar of magazines. She works on the magazine Avalanche, which in the 1970s was very well known for its artist interviews. So she will provide an overview of the interview, and as well as historicize and contextualize the interview. And then we'll hear from each of the panelists about the relationship between the interview and their magazine. So thank you again for coming. Thank you again, Sina, and thanks to our panelists. And I look forward to talking about magazines with you.
So can everybody hear me? Yes? Yes, now? Okay. So first of all, thanks to Lori and to Sina for having me here tonight. I'm very excited to be part of this first panel of the three-panel series and to be discussing the interview. It's also certainly an honor to be here with Betsy Sussler and Lauren Stein, who both are editing these magazines that, as I was just saying to them, have been at different points in time called maybe little magazines, which is perhaps an antiquated term now. But in both cases, their magazines have lived very long and very rich lives. Let me just get this going here. Okay. The Paris Review's Spring 2015 issue marks the 62nd anniversary of what Time Magazine aptly called, quote, the biggest little magazine in the world. And Bonn's spring issue marks its 34th, which is an impressive number, particularly for a magazine whose founders named it Bonn in part for their belief that it was possibly going to do just so upon its release. The Paris Review and Bonn were founded almost three decades apart and initially covered slightly different territories within the arts, with the Paris Review really focused on literature and Bonn tackling the interdisciplinary downtown New York art scene of the 80s, which included at the time really theater, visual arts, poetry, dance, and film, among many other fields. But today, together, they're notable for their ongoing commitment to foregrounding the artist's voice through interviews. So in my introduction, I want to talk a bit about the interview as a form, looking at some specific examples that highlight ways in which the form has been used, who it serves, and how it serves them, and also how we might read this form, keeping in mind the tenuous space that it can occupy, somewhere between talking and writing, and neither a primary nor a secondary document. And the interview has long held and continues to hold today a certain fascination, intrigue, and value as an insider's look into artists' ideas, processes, and even what kind of people they seem to be, a view, so to speak, behind the authorial mask. Through the guise of the interview, we, the readers, can become silent third parties, like flies on the wall, privy to an intimate encounter with a figure of intrigue, with a chance to learn both what he or she has to say about a given topic, and often just as interesting, how he or she says it. Because of the authenticity that such speech seems to hold, interviews have long generated discourses around artists and their work that have been treated as the last word, the perfect punctuation to a scholarly argument, or an enduring soundbite on an artist's work. And I was thinking as I was preparing for this panel about Frank Stella saying in the 1964 radio interview, "What you see is what you see," and how that is a phrase that he will never hear the end of. As one example, I was thinking first about all of the wall labels that we've written where we've included that same line, and of course the whole exhibition on his work with that same title. And as I begin to think about that particular interview, it was conducted as part of a series of interviews by Bruce Glaser and broadcast in February 1964 as New Nihilism or New Art. But I'm sure many of us, especially from the field of art history, know it through its subsequent publication 2 years later in Art News as Questions to Stella and Judd, edited by Lucy Lepard in its final presentation in Art News. Indeed, this interview was considered so essential to an understanding of the two artists' practices that Gregory Batcock included it as the lone interview in his seminal 1968 publication, Minimal Art, A Critical Anthology, still considered required reading for scholars of this period. So as an artist interview, Questions to Stella and Judd offers an interesting point of entry to the form. It was published at a moment when viewers, critics, and historians alike were beginning to look to artists for explanations of their work, following the period of the 1950s and early 60s that was later termed the Age of Criticism. And in this way, the interview was not only seen as something that might be revelatory for readers, but could also be a platform for artists, a chance to set the record straight. I noticed in Lepard's introduction to this interview, she actually notes that the artists themselves challenge and clarify the numerous prevailing generalizations about their work. I also thought it was very interesting that in looking into the Paris Review's first issue, where William Styron had written in a sort of letter to the editor, he notes this whole idea of the age of criticism at that exact period, which is 1953 then. Literally speaking, we live in what has been described as the age of criticism, whereby literature is smothered under the weight of learned chatter. So I want to pick up on a few other points raised in this particular form of the interview that I hope we can keep in mind throughout the evening's conversation. First, what is the relationship between the interviewer and the interviewee or interviewees in this case? And is there an implicit power dynamic there? As with many of the canonical interviews during this period, the interviewer here is an art historian and critic, not a practitioner or otherwise close peer of the artists in question. Does this matter? In magazines like Avalanche and Bomb in the 1970s and 80s, this would in fact matter, as interviewers were typically be part of the same community or share the same sensibilities of the interviewees. Able to speak or at least understand what Liza Bair, co-founder of Avalanche and also founding member of Bomb, had called, quote, the private language of artists. And thinking more about this interviewer-interviewee relationship, I noticed something in another artist's interview that I've probably looked at 20 times before at least, which is Gene Swenson's canonical two-part series, What is Pop Art?, which I noticed was subtitled Answers from Eight Painters. So I started thinking, questions to Stella and Judd, answers from eight painters. And in the very titling of these interviews, we find both the semantic distancing between the parties involved and also the sense that the interviewer had a particular objective in mind. Indeed, the questions from Swenson include not only what is pop art, but also what is your attitude toward pop art and is pop art despicable? And what about the use of the verb conduct that I realize we often use in thinking about the interview? What does that imply a certain power dynamic, some sort of orchestral direction? So by the late 60s, artists' rights movements coinciding with international political and cultural upheaval and protests called for an overall reform of museums, gallery systems, and even magazines, finding ways to put more power in the hands of artists. Among many changes to the face of magazines was a proliferation of primary texts by artists and even paid projects or artworks that were cited for the page. In Lewitt's paragraphs on conceptual art, for example, in Art Forum in 1967, he wrote that we needed to find a way to get beyond, quote, the secret language that art critics use when communicating with one another through the medium of magazines. And around this same time, the same year, 67, artists internationally were also dealing with questions of how maybe we could even think about reimagining the form of the interview itself. And so here I show you a slide of Marcel Breuter's imaginary interview with René Magritte, where he basically imagines having this formal interview with someone who he had met several years before, and whose work had often been compared to Magritte, and he himself now puts himself in the seat of power as the interviewer. And basically, it's a literary exercise and ultimately becomes an artwork in the end. So within the visual arts, interviews can often feel particularly revelatory, as we are accustomed to interpreting silent works. And of course, one thing to keep in mind here when I'm thinking also about the year 67 is that the form of the interview really kind of began to blow up around this moment in artist magazines, which oddly enough coincides with Roland Barthes' The Death of the Author, which was really beginning to gain traction around that time, itself being published first in an artist magazine in Aspen 5 and 6 in fall winter 67. So this is another paradox, I think, that's interesting to keep in mind. Why the fascination with the voice behind the work if we're supposedly working at a moment where it's the birth of the reader and not the birth of the author? Another magazine that I was thinking about in this regard in terms of approaching the idea of the interview in a more critical way would be Warhol's Interview magazine, which was published first in late 1969. And of course, headed by Warhol, who himself had often expressed frustration even within the interview, in the very interviews of his work. And here you have this very self-conscious noting of the perils of the interview form in the one of the first interviews, which I actually included here as a quote. In this conversation with Agnes Varda, there was a preface by the interviewer. The interviewer, Soren Agnew, does not like the form of the interview and the implication of the form, that the person has information to be given to the interviewer, which the interviewer does not have and cannot get except by asking, which I thought it was just this perfect encapsulation of like all of these issues at this moment. And so here I want to just very briefly talk about Avalanche as a way to introduce these kind of final issues before turning it over to Betsy and Lauren. So in 1970, when Avalanche's first issue came out, I should have gone this way, but I'll start here anyway. In June 1970, Art Forum basically upped Avalanche, which had originally thought they would be the first magazine to publish an interview with Carl Andre, but were beat by just a few months by Art Forum. And what I think is so fascinating about the publication of looking at these two interviews side by side is you really begin to get a sense of the different approaches of the two magazines. You'll see just in looking generally at the Art Forum interview that you'll have a single question and a very, very long answer. You definitely still are getting the sense of this sort of question-answer mode. It's actually a great interview. There's a lot. I mean, Andre is quite open, and there's a lot of really amazing information there. But just the look of it and the feel of it is a very different experience than the interview that would be published in Avalanche a few months later in its inaugural issue. Which is coming up a little bit blurrier here. Let's see if this is clear. Okay. So what I wanted to say here is this idea of Avalanche trying to foreground the artist's voice and foreground the conversation, thinking about the idea of the interview as something that's more about communication than about a question-answer dynamic. And you can see even in the way that the interview has been printed on the page that you get this sense of this flow. So that this is something that I've really only seen in Avalanche, but I'm sure it's been done other places, and someone please correct me if I'm wrong. But the idea that a statement might end and then the response by the other party begins at about the same spacing on the page where the other ends up. So you sort of fill the blank. So it sort of flows back and forth versus being all like left aligned on the page as a sort of standard question-answer setup. This, along with the idea that Avalanche often would incorporate the sounds of the interview, getting a sense of the texture of the interview, the that just shows that Willoughby Sharp is listening and understanding and following, but it hasn't actually interjected a separate question. This also brings up something that we just mentioned very briefly here and that Laurie mentioned in introduction, which is the question of the editing. So if you think about the interview as something that usually exists first as a recorded conversation, sometimes, as we see in one page from one of the interviews with William Wegman for Avalanche, I think this one's the 5-hour. Yeah, this is a 5-hour five-hour audio recording. Then this has to be transcribed, and from that transcription, edited down to be something that still maintains a sense of the feel of the interview. And so what happens between that and the final work on the page is something that I'm very interested in, and that I hope also we can talk more about on the panel. Something that Avalanche, I think, tried to address very directly. You can see even on this one page of Liza Bair's interview with Wegman where you have the word pause put in there. And she, through this interview, she's literally sitting there with Wegman watching his videos saying, can we put up the next reel? Yeah, okay. And then they read it, then the reel, then they actually transcribe what's happening on the screen and then discuss it. So you really get the sense that you're part of this conversation. And the last point I wanted to make in relation to this sort of idea of the transmission between the recording of the interview, the being there of the interview, and what's actually printed on the page is something that I think is particularly dynamic in this discussions with Heiser, Oppenheim, Smithson, also in Avalanche's inaugural issue, in which it's hard to read in the very bottom here, but it the very bottom of the image says, these discussions were held in New York from December 1968 to January 1969. So again, noting the sort of temporal quality of this, the interview process. The transcript was edited in collaboration with the artists. Heiser's remarks are in italics, Oppenheim's in Roman, Smithson's in bold. So you, as the reader, going through this interview, it's actually totally crazy trying to follow what's happening, because you have to really be careful, because also what's not noted there is that Avalanche, as the interviewer, this is the point before the founders Willoughby Sharpe and Liza Bear were actually using their names as the interviewers, they are there as interviewers in a slightly lighter Roman font. So you basically have four fonts that you try to follow through here, trying to get a sense of who's talking, who's responding. And the thing that I love about it, though, is that if you just sort of sit back and read, you do have this sense that is very unusual in reading something on a page of being part of this conversation, or someone who walked in and heard all of these, this kind of cacophony of voices. Same interview. So I wanted to just end with a couple of sort of slides as an introduction. First, thinking about Baum, I was thinking about this idea of trying to capture the sense of the conversation, of being, of sort of the being there. And something that Betsy had actually said in a recent interview, that the end result was important, of course, but what was really important was the conversation taking place around the creation of the artworks, whatever they were, which I really liked. So really kind of thinking about these, the two parts of the interview, of both the what happens in the present, in this moment, and also how that can transpire on the page. And how even just, again, visually speaking, looking at a page like this, where you get a sense of this very strong distinction between something like the Carl Andre interview that we saw from Art Forum with these question and very long answer. And here it's this line by line by line, a real, like definitely a conversation, a quick back and forth, a working through of ideas. And last, in terms of the Paris review, which I'm very excited to hear more about and think more about, because I've been very much steeped in the world of artists, magazines and artist interviews, and thinking about what it means to interview a literary figure whose very form is language, and how what we learn from how they speak in an interview can enhance and also complicate our sense of them as a writer. And in the first issue of Paris Review, where there was an interview with E.M. Forster, the preface to that interview seems to suggest the sense of what an interview on the page might lack. In reading what follows, the reader must imagine Mr. Forster's manner, which, though of extreme amenity, is a firm one, precise yet nonetheless elusive, administering a series of tiny surprises. He makes a perpetual slight displacement of the expected emphasis. His habit was to answer our questions by brief statements followed by decorative asides, often of great interest, but very difficult to reproduce. So with that, I'll turn it over to my...
There are seats. There are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 seats down here if anyone wants to sit before we... Testing. Am I on? Can you all hear us?
Can you hear me?
Yes. Yes, cool. Okay. Thank you. That was very informative. I loved it. That was so much fun.
Well, you two are the ones who actually know much more about this whole process and all this. So I hope that you'll be able to maybe talk about the idea of the interview in BOM as someone who was there from the very beginning, and with its somewhat direct relationship to Avalanche also, those ideas in mind of foregrounding the artist's voice, and then how it has evolved over time.
Okay. First, I want to say that Liza Bera of Avalanche was one of the co-founders of BOM, so I was very aware of what they were doing and very appreciative and of it. And so was Glenn O'Brien, who was a managing editor of Interview when it first started. So those of us in a particular scene in downtown Manhattan who were doing theater and film and visual arts and literature, would always have these very informal breakfasts or dinners or late night drinks. And at one of them, and I know you probably all heard this before, but it bears repeating, I said, wouldn't it be great if we all had a magazine where we all got to talk about the work the way we talk about it among ourselves? Now, I was coming from visual arts and also from theater. I was married to a theater director, so we needed to pay checks. He would cast me in his plays. Whether I could act or not was not the question. The two paychecks was ultimately the point. But in rehearsal, it was an ensemble group. And so we developed our approach to the text, to the play, together. And no matter if we disagreed, if someone did not get what was going on in rehearsal, we knew something was wrong. And maybe they didn't have the answer. But in working it out together, we got to one. So when I said that, I thought, it is. It's a process. It's a process in the end of ingesting text or letting it out and having revelations as you go along and letting a transformation take place. So we didn't know how to do a magazine. I mean, Glenn did, Liza did, I didn't, and I claimed to be the editor-in-chief. But they were very helpful, let's put it that way. And we went along and we did this magazine, and I really did edit the first couple of issues as if all the interviews were one-act plays or three-act plays, whatever, because that's where I was coming from, and it seemed the perfect thing to do with dialogue. And I found myself loving it. And yes, I didn't think BOM was going to last. I thought it was going to be like plays at BOM, which is to say the plays that I was acting in, which were opening and closing very, very quickly. But I did have a backup plan. I said, if perchance it lasts, we're going to say it's named after Wyndham Lewis's Blast, because that was the first artists and writers magazine that I knew of in the 20th century. And everyone said, great idea, let's go. Let's call it BOM. So that's how the name. And over the years, yes, conversation, I think, is the key to this. As we started developing these interviews, it became very clear that they were going through a transformation from the spoken word to text, and how are we going to make that elegant, and how are we, in the end, going to make it an enjoyable and a pleasurable read, because, of course, yes, we do want to seduce the reader. It is storytelling. And the other thing is unlike Paris Review, we interview people whose first creative sort of, you know, thinking is not necessarily done in language, is not done in text. So we started treating the transcript as a script in development, something that would alter over time in collaboration with the people doing the interviewer, the interviewee. We still call them that, but it really is based on dialogue. It really is about a conversation. And the editor, so an editor would take the transcript, put it into some kind of readable form so it wasn't overwhelming to work with, and then start embedding questions in it. So we don't edit to change the language. We edit to help people know where they need to be more clear or where we think it could be cut or where we want an idea expanded upon. And then we give it back to the interviewer because, of course, they have to frame the questions appropriately So when the subject is answering them, they're actually answering, you know, a question that's been asked and not, oh gosh, I forgot to write it down. So this goes on for sometimes 7 or 8 drafts. And so what happens in my mind is that this conversation goes from vernacular, which we keep as much as possible, the tone of, the atmosphere of, into a literary form. And I love this transformation. It's beautiful. It keeps something of what it was, and yet it keeps evolving. So really, that's now how we treat the interview form in BOM. And it never gets boring.
Is it always just one original session?
Sometimes there's more than one, but this is what we do. Because it's going to transform from talk to text, most of the subsequent sessions, and we really try to keep it this way, are about writing. And so that way the transformation really does take place literally. And we have many forms of interviews now. We have what I call the epistolary form, the new epistolary form, and that is email back and forth. You know, you ask 2 or 3 questions, they get answered. You ask 2 or 3 more. I think Oscar Hayuelos and Cabrera Infantes did a fax interview because he didn't have a... he refused to use a computer. We just did a wonderful interview with Melvin Edwards, the great African-American sculptor, and he doesn't use a computer. So one of our editors had to go over to his house and hand write all of the answers to the questions that I had embedded in the edit, and then we put it in, and then Melvin would look at it again. So there's lots of different ways of this thing taking place. But it's a very malleable form, and in the end, yes, it's about dialogue. So I find that my theater background actually has fed this so well. I didn't know that would happen, but it worked very nicely. So
when
in any case.
I'm sorry, I wanted to ask, when you said that at first you were editing them as if they were 1 or 3-act plays.
Yes.
How do you do it?
Well, structurally speaking, I mean, they were. You saw that one of those first interviews. They were much shorter, and they were very quick, the Charles Ludlam one. I mean, that they're theater people anyway, so that was rather natural for them. But you just, you know, you think of it as a play. So is this amusing? Is this a hook? Is this leading from one to the other? Is this a segue? Where is it going? Is it working? Is it a non sequitur? Can we dump it? You know, just like this is, you know, or the act really ended here and the train of thought is over here. How are we going to get from here to there? I mean, it's really fun. It's like writing, don't you think? Editing is like writing in a way. It's easier. You don't have the blank page, yes, to have to, you know, come up with something. But then I think in the rewrites, you have to treat it like writing. Only you don't rewrite the people's voices. Just guide them in the rewrites. So how do you edit an interview? What do you do? Do you want to ask that question?
No,
I'm sorry.
That's perfect.
I'm not very good at editing interviews, but there's so many things that I didn't bring a pen and paper, and there's so many things that you touched on that connect obviously with the history of BOM, but also I think maybe to a surprising degree with the history of the Paris Review. And I think that maybe everyone was smoking the same dope without being in the same place.
Yeah.
You know, the so before I forget, let me just go back to some of the things that came up in,
yes,
in your talk. It was so interesting. And this isn't something, maybe this is true for you, but this isn't stuff that at our offices, we don't think very much about these things in an analytical way. We've inherited 60 years of doing it, and there are certain things that we know sound right or sound wrong to us, but we're not very good at thinking about it. So I've already learned a lot. When Betsy and I were talking about money before this started and how we raised money, both magazines raised their money in April for the year, and apart from what we cover by selling, and both are for sale, the back of the
yes.
But in 1952, George Plimpton was trying to raise money to start this magazine with Peter Matheson, and he asked his parents for money. And in one of the letters, it's always interesting what people say when they're trying to get money to do a magazine, but he told them that he was explaining what he was going to do, and he said that he'd lined up an interview with an old teacher of his, Forster, that it was going to be an essay in dialogue on technique. And the odd thing about the past review is the continuity, that from issue one, the basic method hasn't really changed. The possible methods have changed, which means things that were givens have become choices and have become self-conscious. But there's a stated reason for doing interviews in the Paris Review at the beginning, or an implicit reason, and that is that that criticism, in an age of criticism, it makes sense to go straight to the horse's mouth. Mm-hmm. Now, you can hear that's a very anti-intellectual position, because in 1952, 1953, a lot of people would wonder whether it made sense for, before Bach, it's already a strange thing to do, to say, we won't have writing about writers. We'll go to the writers and ask them what they think they're doing. Why? I think, it's a paradox, but it makes sense that someone who would, that in a moment of criticism, a certain kind of editor would want to take a strong stand for the mystique of the author and for the authority of the author. So that's the kind of stated and implicit reason. Then there's this other thing, which is that if you're starting a magazine, you're never going to get Ian Forster to write anything for you. So this was a cheap and doable way of getting famous writers into the magazine. And it turned out to be really the only part of the magazine that people reliably read.
That's really interesting, too, because this is very short, that many of the magazines that I have been thinking about, and I think Baum is in the same category, these are magazines for which the artist interview functions as a way to almost introduce emerging artists. And the Paris Review is sort of the flip of that, at least from its beginnings.
And that's the other thing, is that in the beginning, actually, they're doing more introducing of writers who, especially foreign writers, who won't be known in the States.
That's true. Yeah.
But also, they're going, Ralph Ellison, Dorothy Parker, they're going in the very first couple of years, they're going to their heroes, mm-hmm. right, Forster. Mm-hmm. And it becomes a kind of lifetime achievement prize. And then, suddenly, the question of power, I'm the old one in the office, by a long shot, I'm the old one in the office, and, it's a bunch of kids sitting around deciding who, we only can do 8 a year, maybe one or two more, but deciding what has become, probably because of the Hemingway interview or the Faulkner interview or the pair of them, mm-hmm. it's become this kind of prize, but no one set us up to give that prize, so. there are the things that come back to it, but. It's very not conversational, and so it's interesting to me that Baum. I've been reading Baum interviews for a very long time, and that sound, Baum always looks sounds undoctored, whereas Paris Review interviews always look doctored, but I hope don't sound doctored.
Yeah.
But that's the art of us. It doesn't look doctored, but it is.
Right, exactly. That's
And it is an art form, and it is a literary form, I think. And we rather insisted on that pretty early on.
Early on.
Mm-hmm. So. Mm-hmm.
I was thinking about, in terms of the interviews having a certain form in the Paris Review, and I had seen in one of the early statements of George Plimpton, where he talks about the idea that, asking questions like, when do you like to write? Is there a particular place you like to write? And then stating, often when you start with the high-minded questions, you get lost. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was actually quite interesting, because if there is a sort of form that many of the Paris Review interviews take, it still doesn't feel formal. It still feels like you're getting the way that the questions are asked. You're actually, you're getting to certain issues. You're not saying, what is pop art? What is this literary form that you're using? You're kind of getting people to talk in a conversational way. So I thought that was, do you feel like this is something that still is?
There's a lot of ideology bound up in it. It's sort of hard to pick the different strands apart.
Yeah.
I think part of it is a kind of plain-spoken fanciness. Mm-hmm. I think part of it is, is anti-intellectual. I think part of it is strategic. I think part of it is that 1953, and again, the form, the look of the interviews hasn't changed in 60 years, though the meaning of the look of the interviews has changed. I really think that the session of psychoanalysis is really behind. When an interview sounds good to me, and sometimes this happens in the transcript, you know this,
yes.
But every once in a while, someone will ask a tiny question that unlocks pages.
Mm-hmm.
But usually not. And yeah. So usually they look more balmy, and yeah. I mean, except not good. And then the original feeling, and we do typically many sessions or a few sessions, sometimes many sessions. The first feeling of the interviewer when he or she is looking at the transcripts is usually dismay because it looks crappy. And it doesn't look like a Paris Review interview. I mean, crappy in the sense that when you start reading it, it doesn't have that. You know that sound when a shrink asks a good question? I don't know how many of you know this, but there's a quality of silence where things hum when someone asks a beautiful question and you're really connecting.
Mm.
And that's the sound that we're always trying to manufacture in the dark room. In it. And it's really different from a conversational sound. And there's a real power. It means that some writers don't want to do it because even though it looks masochistic on the part of the questioner, because the questioner isn't named, the questioner doesn't get to say anything smart, the questioner often is made to play dumber and dumber, but really the questioner is completely behind the couch. And some writers have insisted that we go closer to a bomb form, but I think that there's something constitutive about that look.
I want to say something about this. You keep bringing the anti-intellectual thing up, and I know exactly what you're talking about, because when BOM started, we were treated by academics as anti-intellectual. I never thought we were. I thought we weren't academic. Different. You can be an intellectual and not be an academic, and it's a very important distinction, and we stood by it, and we still do, even though, of course, we now more and more welcome academics. But I think this conversation thing versus the psychoanalysis is very interesting, because what you're after, what both of us are after, and you talk about it, is that hum, and it's this beautiful kind of moment where a revelation happens, and even the person talking didn't know that they were going to say what they're saying, and they learn something from it, and it's this magical moment. And you know it when you see it, and you just don't quite know. You'll never know how to get to it or what will unlock it. And that's the wonderful mystery of these interviews that almost always happens. You know, if you let it go on long enough, it just will. So, but I know you brought this up earlier. I just want to say, in our interviews, when we're choosing who is going to have this discussion, we really think about a couple of things. Will they be comfortable enough with each other so that an intimacy can arise? Two, will they be challenged by each other, because otherwise it will be a deadly bore? And three, how well researched? You know, not someone who has just gone and read, five books in 3 weeks to prepare themselves, but someone who has had a commitment to this person's work over a long period of time. So there's a kind of stew going already, and those are the things that we contemplate when we're choosing who speaks to whom.
Your interviews have this extra glamour of, of...
Glamour, I love that word.
Well, for me it's glamorous, the idea of listening to Alarcon and Sambra talking shop, talking about what it's like to be a Chilean writer. I mean, there's something very... it's insider in a way that's exciting to me.
Yes, but they've also lived through a civil war.
Oh, I don't mean that I don't mean that I envy either of them his experience. I just mean that there's something, part of what BOM gives you is this, an interview magazine also.
Right, that intimacy.
Is that kind of, the intimacy and the sense that each one is a personage. And that you're seeing something that behind a certain kind of intellectual velvet rope.
Mm-hmm. Well, we hope so. Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you. We like that. Lauren, when did you start at Paris Review? It seems like you've been there forever, but I know that's not
true.
It's
been 5 years.
5 years.
The other thing, the odd thing about the way, I think the reason our interviews have stayed the same is that the guy who started, George Plimpton, did it for 50 years. Mm. So, and really was most interested in the interview section of the magazine. So it, he at different times he would let different people really have the fiction section, or there was always a strong poetry editor, but the interviews were really George's forte and what he really cared about.
But this is interesting with George, because as I remember in his books, he would always become another persona in order to imagine what it was like being a baseball player or whatever, pool player or whatever. And I kind of imagined him doing that in the interviews as well. I don't know, what do you think?
I think, well, this might come back to the, to your question about the, about what those little, the number two pencil questions. How do you write? What do you use?
Right.
What kind of do you use a typewriter? I'm sure George did a lot of homework. In his letters, he turns out to be, this is a guy who goes through life looking like a playboy. He was a playboy.
Yes.
And a beautiful, athletic, funny, self-deprecating Brahmin. He was all those things. But he was also very, very smart, quietly very readerly. And so I think he would do some preparation, but also I think sometimes he interviewed people. He got by on charm.
He was so charming.
He was very charming.
Yes, and so kind.
Yeah.
He was so kind.
You can't fake
it. I still miss him.
Yeah. Oh. I would, except I have his job. But I think that the form partly reflected his own sense of, I don't know if inadequacy is probably too strong, but a sense of not being, I mean, I think we should imagine the interviewer often as being some George or someone like George, a kid. Often it's a young person interviewing an older person.
A mentor,
person.
Right, yes.
Or someone they've never met. I mean, Dick Cavett, there's strange things that happen when you edit the Paris Review. And he said, my favorite interview.
It's back. Sina, where are you, my dears? Hi. Is it working? Because there's this weird echo up here. Okay.
Is it still on?
Yeah, could you move your mic up?
Oh, it's because my shirt is, it's my décolleté.
Is it the hair?
It's the hair. Is this good? Better?
Good.
Dick Cavett was saying that his favorite interview ever was the Paris Review interview with Dorothy Parker. And I remember the interview, but he said, who wrote that? And who did the interview? And I couldn't remember. And I thought it was George. And he said, no, it had to be a woman. And
with Dorothy Parker?
The Dorothy Parker.
Really?
Interview.
It was a woman?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
And I went back and read it, of course. You can tell because she calls, Dorothy Parker keeps calling her honey. But he was saying that the thing that made it moving in the mid-50s was this vibe between women, a younger woman and an older woman. And in general, I think that's an outlier. And usually the person talking is a kind of slightly dumb. I mean, asking dumb questions.
But that's a technique, mm-hmm. too,
yeah.
You know, to get people to talk. I mean, A.M. Holmes has this wonderful technique where she will, when she's doing an interview, confess all of these things to the person she's interviewing. And it's really to make them feel comfortable so that they will do the same in turn. You know, it's a very, and it's, and it works each and every time. So,
yeah. Of course, and Bauman and the Paris Review, this is something that I think is, if I understand right, makes our interviews different from a lot of interviews, which is that the everybody gets veto power, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, they don't get veto power over something they didn't say. For instance, the interviewer doesn't say, doesn't get to tell the interviewee what to say. Oh, absolutely not.
Even in print.
Neither does the editor. It's a really collaborative. If it's your work, your ideas, if it's your train of thought, you get final say. Now,
but would you edit anything? Would you have edited anything within an artist's words, or you know the person you're interviewing, and then passed it along to them to see if they were okay with that? Or
yes, okay. Yes. But if they ask, they can see the transcript.
Yeah. That's a similar avalanche model.
It's fine, yeah.
I think, I may be wrong, I suspect that that might have been a Paris Review invention. I mean, it's a, you would know, do you know?
I don't know. George didn't confide that in me.
No. But the idea that you would do, sometimes our interview with Norman Rush took 3 years, 500 pages,
yeah.
Lots of sessions. The idea that you'd sit down, do as many sessions as you needed, edit them together, basically, typically give the writer a cleaned up version, let the writer rewrite as much mm-hmm. as he or she wants
yeah.
to. Even make stuff up.
Yes.
You did that too.
Oh, yes.
Fred Seidel, the poet Frederick Seidel, interviewed his mentor, Robert Lowell, in the 60s, and discovered that the reel-to-reel hadn't been on, or hadn't worked. It had been back. How can you screw up a reel-to-reel? Anyway, it didn't work.
It went backward. It happens. They were in rewind, yes.
They were in rewind. So we just made it up and presented it to Lowell.
Uh-huh.
And then when we were doing an interview with Seidel a few years ago, my then boss, before I worked at the Paris Review, my then boss did the interview, and Seidel didn't really like the way it sounded. The editors at the Paris Review weren't happy with it. And we spent 5 days in his apartment making up new, and by hand, he dictated new answers. I would read him the question, he would make a new question up, dictate a new answer over many takes, I would read it back, and then I read him back all of the handwritten interview.
You're just making it better, right?
Yeah. But you're also letting people hang themselves with enough rope, because the idea is sometimes some people think that we're giving writers too much control. But of course, if you give a writer that, on the one hand, you're taking control out of their hands because you're asking questions, so they don't have to invent. It's the easiest kind of writing to do. Writing, maybe in quotes, but then, in another sense, you're giving them unlimited power and control, because they can futz as much as they want, and that means that they reveal themselves completely. Because if you give someone months to try to make themselves sound good, they will sound just as awful as they could possibly sound, or as good. And it's a way of getting at a part of the person that you would never get in a gotcha, that you'd never get if they didn't feel comfortable knowing that they had that control at that person.
Right. Well, you know, we do have deadlines, and we do try to keep them, because it keeps it from being self-indulgent, which we really don't want to have happen. But there was one between two dancers, and we were 2 days going away to press, and we had saved the pages for them, and they finally said, you know, we're really sorry, but this is a bomb interview, and it is just not up to snuff, and we are not handing it in, and you may not publish it. And 2 issues later, we did publish it, and it was significantly better. So we were grateful that we had waited. So it's a balancing act, and you just kind of, okay, is this getting too indulgent? Do we stop it? Do we just, you know, keep them from putting the foot in the proverbial mouth? Or do we let them play with it as long as they need to? And it's really, you know, I don't know, it depends. And then there's other things. I have this story. We were editing the Luisa Valenzuela, and it was just too long, and we were trying to figure out what to take out. And Luisa finally said, oh, take out the end. I'm not comfortable with it. And we did. And I regretted it, and I regret it to this day. And I called Luisa up, or I faxed her or whatever. She said, you know, I kind of do too. So we decided we would tell it as an anecdotal story to people like you, rather than just have it in the interview itself. And it goes something like this. Luisa Valenzuela cannot find the ending to this short story. It is driving her crazy. It is just not coming to her. So she decides to go out into the park in Buenos Aires and sit there and just stay calm and be quiet and let it come to her. She's sitting there, and a man from the provinces comes in, an indigenous man, and says, I need to talk to you. He comes up to her as she's sitting there on the bench, and she goes, no, I'm really, really sorry. I just need this time to meditate. Please go away. He comes back. I really, really, really need to talk to you. She's like, no, you don't. He comes back a third time, and she says, fine, tell me. Tell me what you need. He tells her the end of her story. It's just, it was... Why did we cut that? What happened here? So, and in any case, so, you know, it's not always the
interview. The end of her story, the end of her interview.
Everything. So, I don't know. You know, it's just, it is this balancing act, and sometimes you hit it and it's perfect, and sometimes you don't.
What do you think of the role of the archive in that case? So with Baum's archives at Columbia, of course, there's the possibility that someone could come along at a later date and discover these sorts of things, these mm-hmm. moments that maybe at the point that that issue is being edited didn't seem essential, but later on will seem integral.
I love that. I love that our archives are at Columbia. But we also have our archives, I mean, and so does Paris Review. We have everything up online.
Mm-hmm.
So people can find it mm-hmm. like that. Mm-hmm. And we want that. And it's an interrelational library. That's how we treat it.
Mm-hmm.
So that people can make connections. But I think,
yeah,
you know, discovery is so much fun. How would you, you know, you want people to be able to have that experience.
When people go to look at our archive in the Morgan Library, they find out that one of our interviews looks unedited, and it's the interview with Jack Kerouac. And it turns out that it's almost as rejiggered as all the others. You know, you've got his wife comes in and complains about his drink, that Berrigan and I forget who the other guy is are getting him to drink, and Kerouac is talking in non sequiturs and gets drunker and drunker, and it's all sculpted. It's really
this like a play, like a one act play.
That one is especially that way.
Uh-huh.
But you know, the question of when an interview would become self indulgent, we've got the luxury that we really tend to cut it off around 8,000 words, and so sometimes it's a little longer. But no matter how long they talk, we're always gonna compress it.
Be brought back,
try to keep the sound.
Right.
One thing that we haven't talked about yet, well, you touched on it, but the question of, you know, now we both have online versions of our mm-hmm. magazine with original content. I did an interview for your online.
Yes, you did. Thank you.
It's a pleasure. But partly because of the internet, but partly from before that, interviews, especially email interviews, are the cheapest kind of content you can produce. And what that means is that for the first time ever, you can't pick up the newspaper practically. I mean, listen to me, pick up the newspaper, but that's still what I do. But I mean, you everywhere you look, you see Q&A form. That's kind of new. And that, to me, that actually points a direction for the Paris Review. I don't know if you feel this way too, but I don't like the sound of email interviews. This is particularly the Paris Review. It's a sound that I recognize very easily. And sometimes it's very useful for cabinet interviews, for example, where people are going to be talking in very about pretty sophisticated stuff. and you need to get a lot of information into a small space, and you want both interlocutors to be pretty valuable, email can be great. And there's a tradition of epistolary interviews. We've done those too, but it's becoming really the default mode for a lot of talk about the arts. And I think there's something valuable, even if you edit it out, having Valenzuela, having the interviewer hear something that was not expected, that can't be censored, even if it's censored later. There will be moments of serendipity that make it into the final interview. It sounds artsy-fartsy what I'm saying, or it sounds... It might sound like a small thing, but it actually, you notice it within half a page as soon as you start reading an interview.
But I have to say, some of our most stunning interviews have been done between writers over email. Like, I think Juno Diaz and Edwige Danticat was done that way. Jonathan Lethem and Jeff Dwyer. And you're talking about consummate craftsmen and masters. And so what you're getting is this beautiful, beautiful text that's not overwritten and that's fluid. And in the same way that you're talking about cabinets, they're covering an enormous amount of ground in a very compressed way. So it's text, and it works. And if it doesn't work, we don't print it or we don't put it up.
Yeah, of course.
So, I don't know.
Yeah. That was actually another question I was going to ask, was about the idea of the email interview, because I think it's something that I think we've come across often in the museum in trying to do an interview with an artist for a catalog, and there's often a, first choice would be to do an email interview, and in a way it's often felt to be this sense that someone wants to really control what they say, that's going to be put into this big catalog.
Right.
But I often feel, I agree that I feel like you really feel that when you read the interview. I don't always sense that losing that atmosphere of the conversation, of even that therapy session where something interesting might come out, that you always get that in an email interview. But this is very interesting what you're saying about, I want to go back and look at those interviews, because I can see how if it's done right, then it really is this exchange versus here are my series of five questions, here are your responses.
Well,
then
look,
it would be interesting.
You know, I'm talking about people whose medium is writing.
Right.
So
right.
We don't do, for the most part, emails between visual artists. They rarely work. And they just sorry. No. But you know, there's also something going on in the art schools, and it's been going on for a long time, for decades, and we have worked against it, and that is visual artists not feeling comfortable with talking about their work unless they put it in another framework of structuralism or whatever, and use this very tight language to try to explain what their work is within that frame. And works, and we're always undoing that, untying those knots, and making them into something more lucid, we hope. So it's hard. So I would never suggest doing email interviews between visual artists.
Should we open it up to questions from the audience?
Take questions from the audience. I'll just ask that you speak into the mic for recording purposes.
Thanks for the interesting talk. I wonder if you would want to share any fantasy interview paradigms that you have or haven't imagined and that you would never dare to actually put in print, but you might want to speculate on in the way that you've been talking so warmly and thoughtfully about what you have actually done.
You know, I don't have any fantasy interviews. If I have a fantasy interview, we do it.
Formats.
Huh? Oh, formats.
How you would change the form.
Oh, interesting. Well, you know, there is one interview that I always go back to because I think it's stunningly beautiful, and I wish that I could, I don't wish I could use it, but I wish people would be a little more adventurous with the form, and that is Sam Shepard did an interview with Bob Dylan, an interview. And Bob Dylan, during the interview with Sam Shepard, kept walking off to answer the phone and have these long conversations. So Sam was musing about, you know, the fact that they were maybe 3 or 4 miles away from where James Dean crashed his car into the tree and died. So you're hearing the interview, and then you're hearing snippets of Bob Dylan's conversation on the phone, and then you're hearing you're reading Sam Shepard's musings about what it must have been like in those moments before the crash and what the sound of the crash must have been like, and they're all intertwined, and it's stunning. And that, to me, is one of my favorite interviews, and I have not ever duplicated anything like that in Baum. But we did have an imaginary interview. You brought this up. And that is that our architecture editor, Carlos Brienborg, always had wanted to talk to Louis Kahn. So he did an interview with Louis Kahn. And we published it, and no one said anything. It was weird. So that's my answer to you. I don't know. Do you have a...
No, I suspect that you must.
Yes, that's a very good
question.
It's a leading question. Yes.
But
do you?
Do I? Oh, I have lots of them, but I'm not here to game you guys up.
We just did a, for April Fool's Day, we launched a children's edition of the Paris Review. And we had a snippet of an interview with the guy who wrote The Very Hungry Caterpillar. And he falls into exactly, you know, he's got a kind of an old-fashioned theoretical framework for what he's for the book. So, yeah. Sometimes it's fun to let people.
Bye.
Other questions?
I just wonder if either of you have any worries about the interview format falling more and more into the trap of celebrity culture these days. I'm an art critic. And more I'm being asked, well, not to write criticism at all, but not even to do interviews, but let other people do interviews. There seems to be more and more of a stress on letting artists just have their say without challenging them, without, you know, the mess of criticism. Right. And that really worries me about the direction that a lot of journalism is going in today.
Right. Well, it doesn't really worry me a bomb because we don't do that. I mean, we don't, it wouldn't even occur to us to do that. It feels like we're the antithesis of that. You know, we go for under-recognized artists. We don't care if someone is a famous artist. We don't treat them as if they're a famous artist. We treat them as if they're an interesting, intellectually compelling artist. And we match them with someone equally so who may be not so famous or so well-known or so recognized. And we really try to balance that between emerging and under-recognized and, you know, people whose names you might know and might want to know more about. And it seems to work. Like in the most current issue, Joan Jonas actually conducted the interview with Rosa Barbat. So it's, you know, it's not that we're not aware, that we're unaware of it. It's just that we would never do an interview like that. Why would you?
But it's still persona-based. It's still part of a larger phenomenon of wanting to deal with the persona of artists rather than their work, no?
But ours are all about the work, not the persona, so.
Ours are all about the persona. what you brought up at first, the question of whether the, you know, are writers interesting? I mean, I think it's an open question, but the Paris Review has really put everything behind the idea that they are, and that famous writers are interesting in a different way from non-famous writers. I'm often having to explain that we don't really do interviews to introduce writers anymore. The writer has to be a household name or someone who's unavoidable in our own circles, in our own minds. I mean, so we can fudge it that way, but I, you know, we traffic in this.
Right. They have a larger circulation than we do. And that's probably why, yes. However, I do want to say one thing. With, you know, we were little magazines at one time, but with the advent of the internet and websites, Baum now has over 1 million readers a year. That never could have happened before the internet. So it's rather, unique reader viewers. So it's rather wonderful to see that, you know, that this can happen and that there are people out there who do want to read that this kind of interview and fiction and poetry and look at artist portfolios, etc.
But, you know, I think in the end, when the archaeologists come back to figure us out, they'll say that the kinds of interviews that we publish do have some intimate relationship to celebrity, to the idea of celebrity.
Why? How?
Maybe it's not true for yours, but for ours, part of what we're selling is a celebrity interview.
Hmm.
And I mean, I don't mean that in a bad way. We don't publish interviews with writers we don't, whose work doesn't interest us, of course. Well, maybe that's not of course, but I can't remember what one was on the screen, but this, the new one is Hilary Mantel, Lydia Davis, and Elena Ferrante. Well, you know, these are three writers who matter a lot to me, but the part of the reason that we interview them is that
they're almost household names.
Yeah, they're a huge deal for us, and so that, to me, that's just part of the way we think. I mean, I guess you were asking if we're afraid. I want writers to be more famous. I mean, if that's what we're going to be, if that's the economy that we're living in, then I just want our guys to get a bigger piece of the pie.
Thank you both so much for sharing this with us. I have one question, which is rather expansive, but I think it bears quite a bit on the interview format, and that's the introduction of the hyperlink into the interview. Mm-hmm. And this is kind of this applies to obviously essays and other writing on the internet, but as we start to read things online, we're then afforded that that option. So I was wondering if either of you have encountered this in an interesting way or have an opinion about it. I know both the Paris Review and BOM don't use hyperlinks at all or very little. So
we use them a lot.
I think it's still interesting.
We use them a lot online. We tend not to use them on paper. Though Josh Cohen once wrote a story where he included a link and he said, "Scratch it."
So do you think about that at all when you're?
You know,
when you're,
I don't think that people are necessarily reading the interview to, well, and some people are reading the interview to do research. But I still think it's about the train of thought, the flow. Like, I don't even like rearranging what happens in the interview as the conversation takes place. So I don't like people going offline, as it were, or into another text. They can do that later. So what we do is
and
we don't
I think
hyperlink.
That works really well for BOM's format. I was wondering if all of you could speak more generally about the introduction of the hyperlink. Because it does exist, and it is an important technology of
yes,
the interview.
It is, right, and it's great for research, but I'm not interested in it when I don't want our read interrupted. I can't talk about it outside of the context of BOM because that's where I have control, you know. But what we do is we put the suggested readings down at the bottom so that people can follow, like, you know, like if it's a Combe Toybeane interview, if, you know, he did another one, they can see that there's another one in BOM, that sort of thing, so.
Yeah, I mean, one of the formal constraints in our interviews is we're always keeping interviewer and interviewee from going too much into depth in a particular work. And that's one of the constant, interesting problems. But if you take, you know, you're taking away the net in a tennis game, and suddenly you can go and look at the story that we're avoiding talking about, or. There are a few formal constraints that are always there. One is that you always take out the part where people talk about Tolstoy and Proust. And as time goes by...
We don't always.
Well, they used to leave them in sometimes, but now they've been left in enough that they've, you know, there's a small mountain of how much Tolstoy means to everybody. Or it makes it fun. Sometimes you can print a poem. We step out of, I mean, traditionally, we step out of the interview that way sometimes, that we'll print a very short text so that that they can then talk about. In the Lydia Davis interview, actually, that's the most recent time we did it, we had Lydia read a very short poem story of hers and then do a close reading of it. And so maybe that's kind of like the hyperlink.
Yeah, maybe that is. I mean, we have, like, you know, recordings at the top where someone's reading their poem or the same thing. Or in the Joan Jonas interview, for instance, we have her videos interspersed throughout when it's online, so you can watch the video while you're reading the interview. So I guess that would be a form of hyperlink. And we certainly use that because it seems to enhance rather than not.
Speaking of different formats, there's so many, as you touched on, fax machine, playing with formats of interview. Have you ever played with instant message or text message? And do you feel that when you play with formats, there's any obligation of authenticity so that the reader is aware that interviews happen in different formats? Or is your goal to kind of format it in your magazine for the Paris Review or the Bomb format? Or do you ever think about playing with different mediums and making that transparent?
We do, and we do.
Okay.
we say it.
Do you feel that there's any lack of authenticity if you don't?
No.
Fair enough. Thank you.
But the question of authenticity is a big one.
Yeah, huge.
There are plays that we're making, or essays and plays, and we have this incredibly conservative form that lets us, that it turns out gives our writers a kind of freedom and a kind of prestige and a kind of safety and privacy at the same time that they're being revealing. We've never done instant messages. I'm trying to think when that would come up. In the end, it would get stuck into one of those long psychoanalytic answers. So, but we do follow-ups by email, by phone, by fax.
Yeah, that's true. Cut and paste.
So my question is to Betsy. You're doing oral histories now?
Yes, we are.
Are they different?
Are they different?
and to both of you, kind of with like a longer form, since you've both been around for a long time, your magazines, do you ever think about re-interviewing somebody, you know, like 30, they're, whatever, in their 70s or 80s or 90s? And
Well, in answer to the oral history question, we're doing a series, ongoing series of oral histories between African-American visual artists living and working in New York City. And in terms of structures, in terms of frames, I think of them as novellas. They're not quite novels, but they're almost. And so they happen over many sessions, and we treat them very differently in terms of the editing. It's really more about keeping the vernacular, keeping the language, and asking questions that are very specific about fact-checking, really. So what happened here? This isn't clear. What was this person's name? What was the name of your high school? I mean, very, you know, matter-of-fact questions. And we do that because it's not just about the work, but it's their life stories, and it's supposed to be comprehensive. But I'm still very interested in making it, because so many of these oral histories are treated as anthropological texts, and I still want to make it about storytelling. So they're still edited down. I think the Edward Clark is 100 pages, but it was 300 pages. You know, I'm still trying to find those threads. I'm still what I call the Hans Hoffman push, whatever that is that he called it, where I'm pushing things back and I'm pulling things forward. And that took 2 years. We worked on that for 2 years. It was sort of torture, but it was absolutely worth it. And I forgot the second half of that question.
Interviewing people a second time.
Oh, yeah.
Like in the 90s and the
80s. Yeah. Well, we're doing that on the web now. Yeah. We're doing that on the web now. Have you all done that?
Yeah, we've done it with Philip Roth. We did it with Joan Didion. Uh-huh. With Roth, it was because the idea, I guess, was that his later books had been so different from the books that he published when we interviewed him the first time.
Mm-hmm.
With Joan Didion, it was because the first one had been art of fiction.
Right.
There was a new category, the art of nonfiction.
Right. Right. Yeah.
You know, the fun thing. I mean, another thing that I think is in the background of your introduction and everything that we're talking about, and behind the idea of an oral history, which actually George Plimpton and Jean Stein, when they did Edie, that's the first autobiography
I
know.
Yeah.
So there's a real. These things are coming out of the same place. I think when you read the early Don DeLillo novels, for example, there's this moment when the tape recorders are portable enough that people start to have we all have two ears, right? But they start to hear conversation as transcript. And DeLillo has a lot of fun with it and makes it creepy. But you know, Libra is a novel in transcript, but even in the ones where he's not listening to tape, and people who are my age or maybe not so much younger, probably younger, you know, you grew up watching 60 Minutes and they'd always play the incriminating phone conversation and you'd see it on the screen. And it didn't sound exactly like talk, but it, and newspapers, they're suddenly checking against tape, not against the reporter's notes.
Yeah.
Magazines too. So I think there's something about the recorded interview that's really very new. That's really a post-war thing, and that's what we're without talking about it. That's what we're playing with, is this idea that we all hear speech as transcript.
Just a quick question. The word documentary never comes up. It's a completely different format.
It's a different form.
So much overlap. In that you can sort of massage the interview in a certain way. You have video recordings, but you completely.
It's such a different form. Video and film are such different forms. And we've done a couple of video interviews, and I can tell you in the editing, I hated it. I hated it because what you're looking for is the essential. And when I'm editing a text interview, what you're looking for is this constant transformation that can happen in a matter of moments. I think writing is much more interesting. I do too,
but we're about to launch a video series.
Yeah, so are we. Well, you know, we're not about to launch it, but we've done a video series, and we will probably do more. And it's just, and finally, the video editor said to me, Betsy, just take the transcript and edit it as if it were an interview for the magazine. Think of it that way. And when I started thinking of it that way, I could actually edit. Well, she edited the video, but she edited them according to my script, which I used, which I made as if it were a film script. See, I use every other form but the interview form to describe what I'm doing, but it worked. I don't know how else to explain it. Yeah, there seems to be, until you start doing it, until you actually, it's a very different medium.
We've gone the other direction. Our videos haven't had anything to do with editing them, except to say this seems a little boring, this is fun, but they're very, they don't bear any relation to our new style. It just happens to be, it's called My First Time, and it's writers talking about their first play, their first book of poems, their first novel, their first comic book, and we haven't launched it yet, but it's been really fun watching it, but it's nothing to do with what. I wanted to make that very clear. Yeah.
Amazing.
We have time for a couple more questions.
Hi, we've heard a lot about the editing process of the interview, but I wondered about the actual formation of the questions. You know, I think Lauren touched on it before, that almost like a psychoanalytical one where you just place this little, almost like an explosive, and a whole different direction comes forward. I just wondered if we could hear a bit more about how you form the questions for the interview. You know, is it years of background research, is it the stewing, or is it, you know, just kind of the timing almost?
Well, that's so
personal to the person forming the questions. So, you know, and yes, and that, and they're all distinct personalities, and they all have, if not agendas, curiosity that they want satiated. So, you know, but that's a, everyone has a different approach and a different style, and that's what makes it compelling and interesting in the end. We don't do the, like, you know, 10 basic questions. We just don't, so.
That's true for us, too. The one difference is that because we have many sessions, often I'll have seen the transcripts of earlier sessions. There's one of my favorite interviews that we did lately was with not an especially famous writer, Adam Phillips, a psychoanalyst. First time we've done
he's great. We did him, too. He's so smart.
He's so smart. Oh. And he's so, in some ways, so much clearer in interviews than he is in his aphorisms.
Yes.
So
yes.
That was 6 sessions. 4 of them were in public, 2 of them were in private. And the interviewer and I talked a little bit about when they were about to be in a hotel room and doing a private interview, we talked a little bit about what kinds of things could be clarified, or sometimes I find myself wondering what a line of questioning more than a question.
When you say public, you mean like this?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
But actually bigger. Bigger than this.
Really?
Yeah, George Plimpton started doing that. There's a great Le Carré interview that was at the 92nd Street Y.
Oh, what a great idea. We'll start doing it too.
Any other questions? Well, I just want to say, after hearing that the codified set of questions is actually what constitutes the difference between the interview and the questionnaire. Which came out of the interview in the late 19th century. So thank you so much for being here tonight. I hope you can come on May 11th and June 18th, and I want to thank our panelists for such an interesting set of discussions. Thank you.